Right now, the steel beams inside the building you were sitting in are experiencing, well, an invisible microscopic identity crisis.
Yeah, an identity crisis is exactly right. We look at a massive bridge or, the structural columns of a skyscraper, and there's this comforting expectation of permanence.
Right. You assume it's just solid.
Exactly. But if you actually zoom in, like if you look at that exact same steel under a microscope, that solid static image just totally shatters. You're looking at a microscopic landscape that is constantly trying to fundamentally restructure itself.
Which is wild to think about. And if engineers can't figure out how to control that microscopic shifting, those towering skyscrapers and massive bridges would, I mean, they would literally lose their
They
strength.
really would.
And that's what brings us to today's deep dive. You, our listener, handed us a wildly fascinating, albeit highly technical puzzle. You sent over a metallurgical paper titled Grain Growth: Zener Pinning of Grain Boundaries by Oxide Particles.
Yes, by Kenichi Terasima and HKDH Beja. It is a beautifully specific piece of research. To control how strong or flexible a material is in the human-sized world, you have to dictate how it behaves in the microscopic world.
Makes sense.
And this paper looks at exactly how we can step in and freeze that microscopic shifting before it weakens the metal.
Okay, let's unpack this. How do we actually intervene in the microscopic structure of a material when it naturally wants to change? Like, what is the metal actually doing down there?
Well, to understand the intervention, we really have to start with the fundamental premise the text lays out. Metals aren't just one continuous, uniform block of matter.
Right.
They're made up of millions of tiny microscopic crystals, which metallurgists call grains.
Okay.
When materials are subjected to heat, which, they constantly are during manufacturing, they undergo processes called recrystallization and grain growth. The boundaries between these individual grains physically move.
They move.
Yeah, the grains shift, they consume each other, and they grow larger.
I'm picturing like soap bubbles clustered together in a sink. If you watch them long enough, the smaller bubbles start popping and merging into larger and larger bubbles.
That's a highly accurate way to visualize it, actually. And the core premise of the paper is this: to lock in the final properties of the metal, you have to find a way to inhibit that bubble merging movement.
Right, you have to stop them from growing.
Exactly. You have to physically lock those moving grain boundaries in place, a process the text refers to as pinning.
Pinning. Okay, but before we try to stop a moving train, we should probably figure out what's powering the engine. Like, why do these grains want to grow so desperately in the first place?
It all comes down to energy, specifically the universe's general drive to minimize it. The text breaks down the geometry of a grain's driving force.
Okay, lay it on me.
Think about a single spherical grain of metal. That grain has a volume, so 4/3 pi r cubed, and it has a surface area, 4 pi r squared.
Which is the boundary wrapping around it.
Yes, the boundary. And the critical thing to know is that the boundary itself holds a specific amount of energy. The material basically wants to shed as much of that boundary energy as possible.
Right, and I was looking at the formula the paper uses to calculate that boundary energy, the capital E formula,
Oh, yeah.
and there is a very specific detail that caught my eye. The equation takes the total surface area of the grain, multiplies it by the energy per unit area represented by gamma, but then it cuts the whole thing in half.
Yep.
Why are we cutting the energy burden in half?
Because a grain boundary doesn't exist in isolation. It's physically shared between two adjacent grains.
Oh, I see.
Think of it like a wooden fence between two houses. You don't own the whole fence, right? You share the responsibility of it with your neighbor.
Right. Okay.
So when calculating the energy burden of one specific grain, you only account for half of that boundary energy.
So, because they're packed tightly together, sharing walls, the entire block of metal is trying to reduce its total number of walls. It wants to lower its overall energy state, so the bigger grains just swallow the smaller ones to reduce the total surface area.
That is the fundamental drive. And the paper actually puts a number on this driving pressure.
By taking the derivative, right?
Yeah, by taking the change in energy over the change in volume, dE over dV, which equals gamma over r, they establish that the driving pressure pushing these boundaries outward is roughly 0.1 megapascals.
0.1 megapascals. Okay, well, that sounds terrifying. I'm picturing like an industrial hydraulic press crushing a car.
You'd think so with a word like megapascals.
Right. We have to brace the metal against this massive explosive force tearing it apart from the inside.
But what's fascinating here is it's actually the exact opposite. 0.1 megapascals is relatively weak.
Wait, really?
Yeah, to put it into perspective, it's roughly equivalent to 1 atmosphere of pressure. It's essentially the ambient air pressure in the room you're sitting in right now.
Wait, so it's just a steady, gentle nudge?
Just a gentle, persistent push. And this is like the most critical realization in the entire paper.
Why is that?
Because this driving force is so weak, you don't need impenetrable microscopic brick walls to stop the grains from growing. You just need to introduce tiny, strategically placed obstacles.
Which brings us to the actual mechanism used to stop it, Zener pinning, named after the physicist Clarence Zener.
Exactly.
If the driving force is just a gentle push, what exactly are we putting in its way?
We introduce what the paper calls second phase particles. The text specifically describes them as insoluble, incoherent spherical particles.
Okay, basically we scatter tiny microscopic spheres throughout the metal.
Yes. And these spheres don't dissolve into the surrounding material. They just sit there, acting as a drag on the moving grain boundaries.
The explanation of why they create drag is what absolutely blew my mind when I was reading the source material.
It's super counterintuitive, right?
Completely. It goes against every instinct I have about physical collisions.
Most people assume it works like a physical blockade. Like, you picture a boulder sitting in the middle of a highway and a car just smashes into it and stops.
Exactly. You picture the moving boundary bumping into this little sphere and just, you know, stubbornly getting blocked.
Right.
But the geometric reality described in the text is entirely different. The boundary doesn't bounce off the particle.
Nope.
It physically intersects it. It passes right into the space occupied by the sphere.
And when it does that, the overall grain boundary area actually decreases.
It's like taking a hole punch to a sheet of paper. Where the particle exists, the boundary simply doesn't have to.
Exactly. The boundary effectively loses a circular patch of itself.
And remember, our golden rule from a few minutes ago, boundary area equals energy.
Right.
The entire reason the grain is moving in the first place is to reduce its boundary area.
So when the boundary hits the particle and loses that little circular patch of itself, it is temporarily resting in a lower energy happy state.
It basically gets lazy.
Pretty much. Because to keep moving forward, to pull itself away from that particle, the boundary has to recreate that missing patch.
Oh, wow.
It has to generate new surface area to heal the hole. And creating new surface area costs energy.
That is the absolute essence of Zener drag.
Nice.
The particle isn't physically pushing back. The boundary is just reluctant to spend the energy required to detach itself from the particle.
Right. It is a localized energy dip that the boundary gets stuck in.
Let's really try to visualize the geometric model the text uses, because I feel like it crystallizes the whole concept.
Okay, yeah.
Think of the particle as a solid sphere floating in space, and the moving grain boundary as a flat planar surface like a sheet of glass passing through it.
Passing right through the sphere.
Exactly. Where the glass slices through the sphere, they form a circle. The perimeter of that circle, right where the glass touches the edge of the sphere, is the restraining force. It is quite literally a microscopic surface tension trap.
Surface tension trap is a great way to put it. The paper calculates the exact drag force a single one of these particles exerts, based on the radius of the sphere and the energy of the boundary.
But of course, one single microscopic trap isn't going to stop an entire shifting landscape of metal.
No, definitely not. One pothole doesn't stop traffic across an entire city.
Right. So how densely packed do these particles have to be to actually matter? We have to scale this up to an entire array of particles scattered throughout the material.
This is where the paper transitions into the mathematics of drag pressure. They model a random array of these spherical particles mixed into the metal.
Okay.
The two main factors are the total volume, all the particles take up the volume fraction, F and how many individual particles there are in a given space, N sub V.
But the moving boundary, like our moving sheet of glass, isn't going to hit every single particle in the metal at the same time, right? If a particle is a centimeter away, the plane doesn't care about it yet.
Precisely. As the boundary moves, it only interacts with the particles that are close enough to intersect it.
Makes sense.
The text notes that only particles located within a distance of their own radius, lowercase r, can intersect the plane at any given moment.
So that gives us our number of intersections, n sub s, which is 2r times n sub v.
Exactly. Based on that geometry, the paper derives a formula for the total drag pressure exerted by this entire array. And the math is brilliant because it boils down to a fairly simple relationship.
Okay, let's unpack this. The final drag pressure formula, big P.
The total drag pressure is proportional to the total volume of particles you've added, multiplied by the boundary energy, gamma.
Got it.
But then it is divided by the radius of the individual particles, so 3F gamma over 2R.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because if the radius of the particles is in the denominator of the equation, that is a massive mathematical quirk.
Yeah, it really is.
As the radius of the particles shrinks, the overall drag pressure actually multiplies.
It does. It's one of the great paradoxes of material science.
Wait, so counterintuitively, a massive amount of tiny microscopic pebbles creates significantly more drag pressure than a few giant boulders, even if they take up the exact same amount of total space in the middle.
Yes. If you have a fixed volume of second phase material, say 1 gram of oxide, to mix into your steel, you do not want it to form large, chunky particles.
You want to break it up.
Exactly. You want to disperse that 1 gram as finely as physically possible. Thousands of tiny spheres present drastically more total intersections for the moving grain boundary to get trapped in.
Because every single tiny intersection is another hole punch. Every single one forces the boundary to create new surface area to detach.
Right.
It's the difference between trying to wade through a room filled with a dozen giant beach balls versus trying to wade through a room packed waist deep with millions of ping pong balls. The sheer number of tiny obstacles creates vastly more drag.
The paper definitively proves that fine particles yield a highly significant drag pressure. And while having established the theory and the mathematical models, the authors didn't just stop there.
No, they had to prove it.
Yeah, to prove this actually works outside of a chalkboard, they ran a physical experiment.
And the setup for this experiment involves a remarkably specific piece of metal. They used a steel sample with a chemical composition of... All right, bear with me here.
It's a mouthful.
It really is.
Yeah.
Iron with 0.06% carbon, 0.3% silicon, 1.02% manganese, and then it just keeps going.
Yep.
Copper, nickel, chromium, molybdenum, all carefully measured down to fractions of a percent by weight.
They weren't messing around. It is an intensely deliberate alloy. They controlled every single elemental variable because they needed a completely baseline internal structure to test their theory on.
So what did they do to this carefully crafted, highly specific piece of steel?
First, they polished the sample metallographically to get an absolutely pristine surface to observe the microstructure.
Okay.
Then they subjected it to a brutal thermal test. They heated the steel to 1,200 degrees Celsius.
1,200 Celsius? That's, what, a third of the weight of the surface of the sun? That is an absurd stress test.
It is blistering. The purpose of pushing the temperature that high was to thermally etch the austenite grain boundaries.
Austenite being a specific phase of the steel.
Exactly. A specific high temperature phase of steel. At 1200 degrees, those austenite grains have absorbed a massive amount of thermal energy. They desperately want to move, expand, and consume each other to lower their energy state.
So they basically turn the driving force up to maximum.
They really did.
It's the ultimate test of the equations we just walked through. So did the Zener pinning actually hold up against that kind of thermal chaos?
To find out, the researchers tested multiple samples of this steel. They kept the base composition exactly the same across all of them, but they changed one crucial variable.
Which was?
The concentration of oxygen.
Oxygen. I usually think of oxygen as a gas or, you know, something that causes rust on the outside of metal.
Right. But in this context, inside the molten steel, the oxygen forms fine oxide particles. Those are our second phase particles.
Oh.
The microscopic pebbles acting as the surface tension traps.
Ah, so by adding oxygen, they're intentionally creating the obstacles to trap the grain boundaries.
Exactly. They prepared samples with oxygen concentrations ranging from incredibly low, just 10 parts per million by weight, or ppmw, all the way up to 560 ppmw.
Just to put that in perspective, parts per million is an absurdly small amount. We are talking about trace dustings of oxygen within the bulk metal.
It's a tiny fraction.
Oh.
But the micrographs, the microscopic photos of the metal, taken after that 1,200 degree heat treatment, they were incredibly clear.
Did it work?
The text states definitively that the oxide particles perfectly serve their purpose. They successfully prevented the growth of the austenite grains.
Even at 1,200 degrees, these microscopic trace dustings of oxide held the line.
They held the line. And the most compelling data point validates the mathematical quirk we discovered earlier.
The radius thing.
Right. The paper concludes that as the oxygen concentration increases, the final austenite grain size definitively decreases.
Because more oxygen means a higher total volume of those oxide particles, which translates directly to more particles intersecting the boundary, more microscopic surface tension traps, and a massive increase in the total drag pressure locking everything in place.
Exactly. The sample with only 10 ppmol of oxygen ended up with relatively large grains because there simply weren't enough oxide particles to pin them effectively.
Right.
But as the researchers bumped the oxygen to 110, then 140, 270, 350, and finally 560 ppmol, the final grain size shrank dramatically.
Wow.
The moving boundaries simply couldn't push past the dense, microscopic ping-pong ball pit of obstacles.
We started this deep dive looking at a massive, seemingly static skyscraper, and we ended up in a 1,200-degree microscopic war zone. It's amazing that a process so chaotic on a thermal level is actually governed by such elegant, predictable geometry.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this isn't just an abstract mathematical exercise.
Definitely not.
The macroscopic strength, the flexibility, the fatigue resistance of the materials building our entire modern world, the planes we fly in, the medical implants we rely on, all of it hinges on engineers understanding and manipulating these invisible energy equations.
It's engineering at the level of individual crystals. And that actually leaves me with a final lingering thought, something from the text that really stuck with me.
What's that?
We've been talking entirely about perfect spheres, but the paper briefly notes that anisotropic particles are particles that aren't perfectly spherical, but rather, you know, oddly shaped, elongated, or flattened, might exert an even greater drag pressure than spherical ones.
Simply because they present more surface area for the boundary to intersect.
Right. Anisotropic shapes maximize the geometry of the drag. They force the boundary to create even more surface area to escape.
It's an interesting idea.
It's like laying down microscopic spike strips instead of just speed bumps. If metallurgists can already freeze a metal's internal structure so perfectly using simple random spheres of oxygen, what entirely new, ultra-strong materials might be possible if engineers figure out how to specifically design, align, and embed complex, irregularly shaped microscopic anchors inside our metals?
That is the frontier of material science, a completely custom-built microscopic foundation.
Something to think about the next time you drive over a steel bridge. Until next time.